So, we are in Shoftim, still, in the beginning of the 8th parak, the 8th chapter, we're at Pasuk Dal, sentence 4. Let's do a little bit of a recap. I gave you on the top of the sheets a little bit of a digest, because after a 2-week gap, that can be useful. So, we were introduced to Midian and the history of Midian with the Jews and what they seem to represent in their interactions with us, primarily this issue of dividing people from the community, which comes back to haunt us in the 8th parak, as we'll see. Gideon himself we're introduced to, and we found out just how much we don't know about him in terms of why he was selected in the first place. Was he idolatrous with his father in the beginning or not? What are the traits that he displays? We talked about his bravado when he faces this malach or navi, and his response to the malach or the navi. The initial statement is, well, where's God been all along, and why is it that he's letting us suffer in this way? Where are all the old miracles? Gideon has some parallels, as we saw, to Abraham and to Moshe. Abraham, the parallels in terms of his father being an idolater, and also in terms and breaking his father's idols, but also in terms of asking for signs in the way that Abraham did. We also noted parallels to Moshe, where Moshe asks for signs and also has an interesting first conversation when God charges him with leading the Jews. We saw that Hashem gives Gideon signs, and we gave different explanations for the value of these signs, whether it's to show that he's going to carry out the promises. The promises are not just a possibility, but they're reality. God is committed to it. Whether it's to win over not just Gideon, but the Jews to whom he's going to report, or whether it's to encourage Gideon, because Gideon is being asked to do incredible things. And we noticed a parallel between each sign and each mission Gideon is given, where each time Gideon is asked to do something remarkable, Hashem does something remarkable on his behalf first. So he has the sign where this being, whoever it is, burns the food offering that Gideon gives, right? Other than the soup, which is poured out, as we discussed amply. And then Gideon destroys his father's altar and kills the 7-year sacrifice. What happens with the other bull, we noticed some debate on. And then the second miracle was first that the wool should be wet and the ground around it should be dry, and then reversing it, that the wool is dry and the ground around it is wet, leading to Gideon calling the army of all the people who kneel or lap up the water with their mouths, and in general going to battle with 300 people instead of the, 30-something thousand who he originally had. And then the third miracle is the dream of the Midianites, the barley cake that crushes the tent and saying this represents Gideon, and that leads to Gideon leading his nation into war. That we already saw, that was Perek Vav and then Perek Zion. The Jews follow Gideon into war. Gideon is successful in the battle. Remember, they cry out a sword for God and for Gideon, which at first was kind of shocking. Like telling the people to rally in God's name and in His name seems to represent a degree of inappropriate hubris for this leader. That was at the end of Perek Zion of chapter 7. But we explained that it's potentially justified by the fact that Gideon knows that Midian is intimidated by him. That was Abarbanel's point, that Midian is scared of him, and so by invoking his name, it's going to take advantage of their fear. It also pointed to the general balance of miracles and natural strategy that we see here, which Ralbag pointed out. That's what's supposed to be. You're supposed to, on the one hand, do what you need to do to succeed, and yes, trust that Hashem is going to help you to succeed as well. So they succeed in their battle with the enemy, and then they go off towards the east to capture or to destroy the remnants of the Midianite armies. We saw that they want to get to the water, and we give two different explanations for what the water is. It's actually going to become relevant again in today's parak. Either it means the water supplies, So go to the watering holes, go to the wells, whatever it is, because that's where the troops are going to go when they need to take a break. Or alternatively, it means try to get to the Ardain before the Midianite armies are able to get there in order to cut off their exit. So we then saw the brief passage in the beginning of Parakut, in the beginning of the eighth chapter, in which we saw the first sign of decline of the Jewish people, and that was the ingratitude of Ephraim. And it wasn't exactly clear when this happened, whether this was during the war, whether this was during the mop-up east of the Ardain, east of the Jordan, but the people of Ephraim are very angry because they're being called in to do this mop-up east of the Ardain. We saw that back in chapter 7, sentence 24. It said explicitly that they were summoned to do the mop-up east of the Ardain. And Gidon says, I'm sorry, they say to Gidon, you know, why didn't we get to be involved in the core battle? You're coming to us now. And they're very angry at Gidon. And Gidon, rather than respond with, you know, you could have come any time, or say, I was doing what God told me to do, or any number of other answers that he could have given, Gidon's response to them is to say, you know, you guys are wonderful, you guys are great, and you are doing the most important thing. The best things that I did are nothing compared to the great things that you're doing. He flatters them, in order to, to deal with this problem. And, as Ralph Bach noted, he's showing good leadership here. Number one, because he is saving lives rather than end up in a battle with them. And number two, now he's able to pursue the war without delay. If he gets into a long, drawn-out thing, then all the Midianites are going to get away while he's dealing with his political problem. So what Gidon has done is to wisely do away with their complaint. But this element of ingratitude from them, here he is, having led them out from under the seven-year thumb of Midian, that's a problem. That's a trait that we don't like, and that we already noted when we read this in the first place that Ephraim is going to do this again. This is a trait. This is not a one-time deal. They're going to do it again in chapter 12. So it's something that we need to keep our eye on as a sign of ingratitude and division among the Jews. Which leads us to what we're up to now, which are chapter 8, Psukim Dalet Chaf Aleph, sentences 4 to 21. There's an awful lot in this story. I think what we'll do is we'll break it down into two units. First, we'll do sentences 4 to 9, and then we'll go on with the rest of it from there. That'll make it an easier read. So, chapter 8, sentence 4. Everyone have it? Okay. Vayavo Gidon Hayardena. Gidon arrives at the Jordan, which means either that the business with Ephraim was before he reached the Ardain, and read it chronologically, or the business with Ephraim was actually after this, but it was moved out in order that the story should read smoothly. Two different ways you could read it. It doesn't change anything, really, in terms of our understanding in general. So he comes to the Ardain, Overhu, he's crossing, Ushlosh Mayos HaIsha Sharito, and the 300 men with him, Ayefim, they are tired, Virod Fim, and they are pursuing the enemy. Vayomer la'anshei Sukkot. He says to the people of a city called Sukkot. Have you heard of Sukkot before?
Yeah.
Where not just a holiday, but
when they were going through the wilderness, they camped there.
So actually, that has to be a different Sukkot. You're right. The first place the Jews camp when they leave Egypt is called Sukkot. As a matter of fact, there's even one view that suggests that when we say we celebrate Sukkot because Hashem put us in Sukkot, Basukkot Shavti Hashem, that's actually a reference to that city. The reason, or I think the reason for saying that, is because of a completely separate point that's worth thinking about, but it may wake you up in the middle of the night once I mention it. Does the Torah ever talk about the Jews in the Midbar dwelling in Sukkot? Do we ever have a description? What word does the Torah use when it describes the places the Jews live when they're in the Midbar? Ohel. Always Ohel. After Harsinai Shuvu Lochem Le'Ohalechem. Ohel Moshe. Ohel Moed. There is no Sukkah described there. So what do you mean when you say that Hashem had us in Sukkot and that's why we're living in Sukkot? If they didn't live in Sukkot. So one answer you could give is that Ohel and Sukkah, the Torah uses the word Ohel, but it means Sukkah. The problem with that is, then why did you change your word when you got to the holiday? You know, why didn't you use the word Ohel there, or why didn't you use the word Sukkah throughout? Second explanation would be, maybe that's why there's a view in the Gemara in Sukkah, which says that our Sukkot do not commemorate huts, but they commemorate the Ananei HaKavod, the clouds that Hashem protected us with. It's not Sukkot Mamash, it's not real Sukkot, it's the clouds. It's the second answer. But a third answer that's offered is that when it says, Kipas Sukkot Hoshamtias B'nei Yisrael, it doesn't mean I put you in huts. It means, Botziah, as the Pasuk continues, when I took you out of Egypt, I settled you in this place called Sukkot, and took care of you while you were on the run from the Egyptians. So that's what you're actually commemorating, which fits a lot better with a whole bunch of other aspects surrounding the holiday of Sukkot. That's just a side note, but a fascinating piece, I think. In terms of what we're talking about now, though, yes, Sukkot was the first place they camped, but it couldn't possibly have been this one, because it's their first place when they get out of Egypt. They weren't, you know, at the Yarden. So we do have this place called Sukkot, though, up here, so we're going to have to figure out where exactly it is. It's a very important place. I'm sure. Don't worry about it. So, by Yomer Lanshei Sukkot, he says the people of Sukkot, we're in Pasuk Hei, sentence 5. Tenu na kikros lechem la'am asher baraglai. He says... he says, give loaves of bread to the nation that is Biraglai with me. Ki ayefim heim, because they're tired. V'anochiro debach rei zebach v'tzal munam achei midyan. And I, presumably I leading this group, am pursuing zebach and salmuna, the kings of Midyan. Midian's leaders, Midian's political leaders are fleeing, and we need your support. Now, once again, I would expect that their answer would be, absolutely, whatever we can do. Vayomer Sarei Sukkot. However, that's not the response. Instead, the officers of Sukkot said, the singular Vayomer is taken to either mean a representative or them as a, you know, group in one voice. Do you have the hand of Zebach and Salmuna, these two kings? Do you have them already in hand? Such that we should give bread to your forces? That is more than not nice. That's like treason. By Yomer Gidon, Gidon says...
These were Jews. From Ephraim?
We don't know, not necessarily Ephraim. I don't know which Shevet is, Sukkot is in. It's an interesting question. But, it's not necessarily Ephraim. It could be Yehuda, but I don't know. So, Vayomer Gidon, yeah, sorry?
Sukkot is here.
North of Yam HaMelach along the Yarden.
Yeah.
So again, I don't know.
So it looks like Menashe.
Well, Sukkot is east of the Yarden. It is west of the Yarden, I'm sorry. Okay. They mark it as being east.
Territory of God.
Yeah.
Oh, so they're saying it's east of the Yarden.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's north of the Jabbok?
Yabbok is the east-west body of water there that divides in Gad and Menashe. So they're putting it as east of the Yarden. And here he is crossing the Yarden. The reason why I was inclined to say west is something I'm going to come back to a little bit. But, okay, let's say it's east of the Yarden and the land of God. That's as good a place as any. So they refuse. And Gideon says to them, Lachain, therefore, because you took this approach with me, when God gives me zevach and salmuna, you know what I'm going to do? V'dashtias b'sarchem, I'm going to thresh your flesh, your skin. Right? Think of what he was doing with the grain. That's what I'm going to do to you. Es kotzei hamidbar, v'es habar kanim, with thorns and nettles. Okay?
Okay. New battery. So Gideon's response is that I'm going to punish you for this. Okay. Now, if it just happens once, I might think, okay, that's an exception. These people in Sukkot are weird. However, Pasuk Ches, sentence 8, Vayal Misham Penuel. He goes to Penuel. Anybody remember where Penuel was? What Penuel was significant about?
The city was.
It's roughly the same location. You don't know, you have to remember a story. What is Penuel named for? All right, so we're going to get to what Penuel was and what Penuel is known for, because it's going to matter. Vayal Misham Penuel, he goes up from there to Penuel. Vayedaber Aleihem Kazos, and he speaks to them in this way. You know, same thing, we're hungry, pursuing Zevach and Salmuna, etc. Vayanu Oso Anshe Penuel, Kasher Anu Anshe Sukos, he gets the same answer. Have you conquered them yet, such that you demand, you know, help from us? Vayomer gamla anshei Penuel emor. So he also told anshei Penuel, b'shuvi v'shalom, when I get back in peace, etotes hamigdal hazeh, I'm going to knock down your fortress. You guys think you're so tough. Okay, let's pause there. What questions do we have at this stage, just from psukim dalet to test, that it's 4 to 9? All sorts of strange things going on, yeah?
Yeah, the people are not very, don't act in a very Jewish way.
Seriously.
Or unified way.
Right.
They're not really, they don't have anyone's back.
Yeah.
It's like,
but is it the people or is it they? that they don't?
That's interesting. Do we, we don't really get any sense from them.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But they should, it shouldn't matter because somebody who's destroying the enemy, yeah. Like, I mean, they've been persecuted so long that their backs are up, but when somebody comes in...
Who is it who responded this way to Gideon?
It says
the leaders of Israel.
Who is it that he spoke to?
The leaders?
Look more carefully.
He also spoke to me.
Look what it says. No, youth. The youth are coming later. The youth is coming later.
He said to the men.
In Pasuk Hey, he addressed the people of Sukkot. But in Pasuk Vav, it's the officers, the leaders, who respond. Which in and of itself isn't strange. In other words, you know, they're the ones who are authorized to speak on their behalf. However, when you get to Penuel, look in Pasuk Chet, who is it who speaks to him there?
Spoke to them and the men of Penuel.
Right? It's the population that responds. That's an interesting thing. And then another interesting thing here is the difference in punishments. Right?
One's physical and one is against...
Well, they're both physical, but one's personal.
One's a tower.
One's against the people. The other is against something that... property. Or
right. So in order to address this and try to explain what we're seeing here, I want to go back to Sukkot and Penuel. So I gave you references on your sheet. You're all Shoftim specific, except for Ruth. So Ruth can actually look it up inside, but I'll tell you what we're looking at here. Sukkot is, as you see on your sheet, Bereishis Lamed Gimel, the place where Yaakov camps after meeting Esav. Right? Yaakov has been in the house of Lavan. After Yosef is born, decides it's time to leave. They go through the whole thing with getting his salary. He sees that there's hostility from Lavan and his family and decides this is a good time to go. Leaves. Lavan pursues him. Trafim. Rachel dies. The whole story there, right? Then he gets... Actually, not. Rachel's not dead yet. Rachel's alive at this point. He sends messengers to Esav, and the night before he has a mysterious encounter with someone who is clearly not your run-of-the-mill human being, based on the conversation that they have. And after their wrestling match, this being changes his name, and Yaakov is limping. Yaakov then, with his family, encounters Esav. Manages to leave Esav peacefully, and then camps in a place called Sukkot. Sukkot is the first place where he lives, and he actually buys land. It's buying land is Shechem. But it's the first place that he lives after meeting Esav. Okay, that's one note. Second note, Penuel. Penuel is the place where Yaakov fought with the Malach. That passage there, after he fights with a malach, we're told that that is Pnuel, because there he saw Kael. Pnuel like panim, to face, yeah. Correct. The actually, you have the, can you give me the pasuk on that one? It's Lamed Bet, Lamed Aleph in Bereishis. 32-31. I remember the Vayizrachlo Hashemesh, but the pasuk before it is the one I want.
Lamed what?
Lamed
Bet, Lamed Aleph. Yaakov Shem
Hamakom. Yeah.
Pniel.
Right.
Ki ra'iti Elokim panim panim.
Right. So he says, right, he actually names it this, Pniel, Pnuel, both get used there. Because he saw this being face to face, whatever this being was, Malach of Esav, generic Malach, human being animated by a spirit, all sorts of different explanations, Golem. Keep those things in mind, that these bracket the encounter with Esav, Penuel before it and Sukkot after it. So, with this in mind, let's look at this story. In Pasuk Dalet, we know that he is pursuing the Zebach and Salmuna. Rashi adds an interesting note on why he's pursuing them. If you had asked me why he was pursuing them, my answer would have been, what's the logic of pursuing the Midianites?
Make sure they don't come back.
So they can't regroup and attack us again. Right? That's what I would have thought. But look at Rashi. Abarbanel brings this as well, but Rashi is earlier. He says, Ovrim es ha-Yardein acharei Zebach v'tzalmuna, crossing the Yardein, going after Zebach and Tzalmuna, sha'alvru es ha-Yardein t'chila, because they had crossed the Yardein first, which goes back to the question of which bodies of water they were at trying to stop them. Was it that they went for the Yardein but didn't get there in time? Or was it that they were trying to get through all the wells and everything else and didn't manage to get to the Yardein? Either way. It's because Zebach and Salmuna, the Midianites, if you don't get them, so they may not be able to come back west of the Yardein and beat you in your land there, but that whole territory of Reuven, Gad, and Manasseh is vulnerable. So if you take this approach in Rashi, it's part of the theme of seeing all of the Jews as one and taking responsibility for those who are east of the Yardein as well. It's not just a matter of driving these guys off of my land, but I need to make sure that all Israel is going to be safe. But Sukkot doesn't see it that way.
But they didn't have their own warriors too, because weren't they?
God were supposed to be warriors initially,
right?
But it's been a lot of years since then, and evidently they've been living under Midian. So the answer would be no. They've been in trouble. Sorry, what were you going to say? So. So why do they refuse to help? What's this about? Logically, what's it about? Nothing terribly deep.
Unless they know that the other guys are captured, those Zebach and Salmuna could come back and get them, attack them, punish them for siding against them.
Right. So this is the standard approach that the commentators bring, is that it's fear of reprisal. Mm-hmm.
That's the nice
one. If we support Gideon and his 300 men, and they don't succeed in beating Zebach and Salmuna, we're going to be on the firing line. They're going to punish us for having aided a rebellion. So we're going to sit this one out. Let's see how Gideon does. And afterwards, we can always, help. Abarbanel has a very interesting take on this. Malbim does as well, but again, Abarbanel is earlier than Malbim, so I'm using the source in Abarbanel for it. He picks up on some interesting wording, which we kind of glossed over. If you go back to the Psukim first, before you read Abarbanel, take a look at the sentences themselves of his request. Chapter 8, sentence 5. He says, give bread, right? Give loaves of bread for the nation with me. Ki ayefim heim, because they are tired, and I am running after Zebach and Salmuna, etc. Right? Now, it's the leaders who respond in the next sentence, and who do they say we're not going to help?
Your army.
your army. In other words, this group is characterized in two different ways, and this is what Abarbanel, with his very sharp eye, picks up on. They're characterized, on the one hand, as hungry people, hungry, tired people. And on the other hand, they are the army battling the enemy. So Abarbanel catches that, and he says, along with the fact that we distinguished between the people responding and the officers responding, he says, Ha'achas, the first part of the request was, Le'yosem ayefim, because they're tired. Va'kel yisparach tziva, halo paros l'reiv lachmecha, v'nefesh nana tasbia. We have various psukim which say, help people who are in need. Right? That's your responsibility. Va'siba ha'sheinit, and then the second aspect of it, Le'yosem adayin rodfim es oyvehem lo shi'as Yisrael kulo, is that we are your fighters, we are your soldiers. We're trying to save everybody. And therefore it would have been appropriate, since, you know, we're fighting for you, they should save, since they're fighting for everybody to save them, so give them food. So there are two different charges that Gideon makes. And their response is, well, we don't want to help your army, that's the response of the leaders. We're not told the response of the people, but that's going to matter when it comes time when Gideon wants to punish them. So hold this in your head.
But Gideon only has 300 people, so if I was a general or a soldier from the other side, from Gad, and I'd say, well, how are you going to beat Zebach and Salmon? You're all 300 very tired and hungry people.
Yep.
So I could see their argument for not supporting.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And we're going to come back to it. You are right, and Abarbanel is going to note it. The Ralbag, of course, kicks in with, you know, it's not like they offered to go to war with him. That would have been a nice thing. Like, hey, let's join the battle.
That's super work,
yeah.
We're all ready to go.
Right. So Gideon makes this threat of, I'm going to thresh you with thorns. It's an interesting threat. Right?
It's pretty nasty.
Well, it's nasty, but also, like, it's unusual. Like, where did that come from? Right. So the Dat Mikra suggests that maybe this was a traditional punishment for people who rebel against, you know, against the king or something. But Radak and Abarbanel make an interesting suggestion, which I can't really take seriously, but I'll explain why. They suggest that this was an area of thorns and nettles. In other words, that was what was around. That part of it I'm fine with. In other words, this could have been a wild area with a lot of thorns and nettles, and he was saying, I'm gonna take those thorns and I'm gonna, you know, like that part of it makes sense. What they then add is that might be part of the reason why the place is named Sukkot. Because Sichaya in Aramaic are thorns.
Like Sukkot.
Not like stock, different, or maybe connected, I don't know. Like, it's sort of a thicket, you know, so maybe it can be. Stock is a shelter. But Sikaya are thorns, and so maybe Sukkot was actually for thorns. The reason why I can't take that seriously is because we were already told in Bereishis Lamed Gimel, it's called Sukkot because he built huts there, because Yaakov built huts there. So I don't know why you need to rename it for the thorns, unless the answer is, well, it was this and that. It's a contributing factor in the name. It's a reason why the name stuck, so to speak. The that was just, you know, on the fly. But in any case, maybe that's why he takes thorns. Okay, fine. Abarbanel picks up on the delay in punishment. I hit him now. Yeah, what are you? Why are you saying when I come back from? Like you're hungry now, so Abarbanel gives the same approach that Ralbag gave to explain why he didn't, you know, deal with Ephraim in a more harsh way. He says, "V'amnam lama lo ha'enisham Gideon miyad." Right in source number 4, why didn't Gideon punish them immediately? V'sam onsham tnai im yilkod hamalachim. He made the condition instead. If I conquer the kings, then I'm going to come back and show you. So who had sleep? Kadesh lo tisakev tshuat hamilchama. Right? As far as I'm concerned, he says it's because that could have delayed the military victory. That could let Midian regroup. So Gideon says, look, I have to prioritize here. You know, I'm mad at them, but not mad enough to sabotage myself. So they'll wait. They're not going anywhere. And then Penuel refuses as well. And Gideon says, I'm going to destroy your fortress. So now you have to ask why this communal type of a thing instead of the personal that he threatened in Sukkot. So three different answers here on your sheet. Source number 5, Mitzudat David. Abarbanel also says it. but I like Mitzvah David's simple formulation of it. Lefisha bat chuli hisagev b'migdal oz asher hayalahem, because they trusted in this fortress of theirs. That was their point. In other words, they're not afraid of Midian. They don't have anything to fear from them. We have this great big fortress. So he says, yeah, I'll show you. Lazamarshi and Totsoso. So he said, I'm gonna knock it down. That's Mitzudat David. Maybe not just protection from Midian, protection from Gidon. They felt, you know, we're safe, what can he do to us? Ralbag offers a second approach. He says they deserve worse than the people of Sukkot. And he picks up on the fact that here it's the people responding and not the leaders. And he says, maybe in Sukkot, it was just the leadership. Source number six. V'hispa'el mizeh. He was energized by this. He was moved to act. Hitpa'alut rav. A great and powerful move. Yeah, there's no really good English word for hitpa'el. It means to be moved to action, but there's no like one word. The leroa tchunasam, because they were so terrible. Ad shlo hiskimu lazor bezos hamalchama, to the point where they wouldn't help with the battle. Afilu zeha ezer hameati. He wasn't telling them, you have to fight with me. Give me some bread. Ulefisha niskimu kol anshei Penuel b'maseh, and since all of the people of Penuel were part of this, unlike Sukkot, where, as far as he's concerned, it's just the generals or the leaders. Omar lintotz hamigdal. So he said, I'm going to knock down your tower, your fortress. V'la rog yoshvav, I'm going to kill all the people who live there. Note, by the way, he adds in something. Not only is Gideon threatening to knock down the fortress, he's going to kill everybody, which I'll tell you right now, he is going to do. Then why didn't it say so? Avakitzer bidvara v'nimna milagalos lehem shiyahar game. Gideon chose not to mention that part. You better keep that part quiet until I get back. Okay. So the Mitzudat David explanation is that it's about the wickedness of their deed, but also about, you trust in your fortress, I'll show you. Ralbag says that it's because they're all bad, so therefore they're going to get this communal collective punishment. Malbim adds another note. He says, going back towards the idea that it's the gravity of what they did, he says, Kihem Elam Terut Sheireim Ipnei Oyev. He says, it was one thing in Sukkot, where they're afraid of Zevach and Salmunah, and what happens if Gideon doesn't succeed. So, it's bad. But these people, what do they have to be afraid of? They have a fortress. They don't need to fear Zevach and Salmunah. When they trust this great fortress of theirs. So he says, I'll show you. I'm going to knock down your fortress. Okay. So we have all of these explanations. The bottom line is that Sukkot and Penuel refused to assist. And again, keep in mind what those cities were originally. We're going to come back to that point. But they refuse to help. Gideon is outraged, but not so outraged that he's going to drop what he's doing with Midian. I'm going to come back and take care of you later. So then he goes off to Zevach and Salmuna. Pasuk Yud, sentence 10. V'Zevach v'Salmuna ba'Karkor. Zevach and Salmuna were in a place called Karkor. U'machanehem imam, along with their camp. Kachameshas asar elef, like 15,000 people. Kol hanosar mikol machaneh b'nei kedem, all of those who remain from the people of the east, which had been, remember, not just Midian, but Midian, Amalek, and all the raiders of the east. Vehanofalim me'av esrim elef ish sholef charev, and the nofalim were 120,000. Bearers of the sword.
The ones who died.
Ah, so that's a big question.
Who killed them all?
Who assumes they're dead? What does the word Nophilim mean?
The whole horde.
Is that how all of yours translate it?
No. We're left.
Yeah.
We're left of all the hosts of the children of the east.
So Nophilim does not mean who right. fell. So why is it that we
don't? Oh, sorry.
Sorry?
Fell.
Oh, they have fell. Everyone has fell in their translation?
Yeah.
Ha.
Or they're fell.
Take a look back. Take a look back at Perek Zion, Pasuk Yud Bet, chapter 7, sentence 12, and tell me what the word nofel means there. Yes. Chapter 7, sentence 12. I think that's what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one. Read the Hebrew and tell me what nofel means. What was that, Bayamek?
Chant.
Yeah. See, there it said, this is before the war, Midian and Amalek and all of the people of the east were noflim ba'emek. The key is that the word nofel does not have to mean to fall in defeat. It can mean they had just plopped themselves down, more or less, spread out in this kind of loose way. If you remember the pasuk with Yishmael, al pnei kol echav nafal, is the description of where he goes and what he, you know, what he ends up doing. Yishmael spreads out everywhere. Nafal doesn't mean to fall,
but
necessarily.
The translation says, for there fell, more accurately, of those that had fallen, 120,000, the extent of the overwhelming victory is thus vividly revealed.
Right, so the answer is that this is a machlokas.
Oh,
there are two different ways to translate them. Not saying all the translations are wrong, I'm saying that there are two different approaches to this pasuk. You could say that it means that there were 15,000 who were in their camp, and then you had another 120,000 who were sort of scattered. That would be one way to read it. Or alternatively, it means 120,000 dead and 15,000 remain.
Yeah.
There, you could legitimately read it either way. Okay.
These 300 killed 120.
No, not these 300. Remember, he summoned all the people from Har Ephraim who came down once the camp was routed.
If you
had 30,000 people up there.
Okay.
If you don't read it exactly, what do you think happened with the 120,000?
I think that they were killed in two ways. Number one was that initial panic in the camp when they're all stabbing each other. And the other is with the group from Har Ephraim who Gideon called down to pursue them. The ones who then complained and said, well, why wasn't... Sorry?
We're weak. We were found, we were on the food, right?
No. The ones who he called down from Har Ephraim in chapter 7.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So what happened was, the way we presented it was, at least according to the way some read it, according to the way everybody reads it, the straight psukim, he summons, after the initial rout of the camp, he summons people from Har Ephraim to come down, and those are the ones who complain and say, well, why'd you wait till now? However, we also noted that within at least one way of calculating what's going on, I think it was Abarbanel, the initial group who he rejected from his army, he told them, stay here, right, until morning, right? And he goes to the Midianite camp overnight, here's the dream, attacks with his 300, they go fleeing, and the people he summons from Har Ephraim are the rejects of his army. The 30,000 people who had not yet gone home, because he told them, wait on Har Ephraim, now come down to attack. Mm-hmm. That was the Barbanel's read, which I thought was brilliant. Okay. So, this group of 15,000, and yes, it's Gideon with his 300, or 15,000 with a potential other 120,000 even. Vayal Gideon derech hashchunei ba'oholim. So Gideon ascends via the Shchunei Ba'ahalim, the residers in tents, meaning you're now east of the Yarden, you're among nomads, people who dwell in tents. Ralbach explains what Gideon does is he comes through the tent area for three reasons. To see if they're hiding among the nomads, right, the remnant of Midian. To find out where they'd gone, meaning by circulating among the nomads he can find out what's going on. And to hide his approach. You can't see them coming. So, Mikedem leNovach veYogbaha, east of Novach and Yogbaha, two cities which are known to us from that area elsewhere. And back in the Chumash we mentioned them. Vayach es hamachaneh, he struck the camp. V'amachane haya betach, and the camp was secure, meaning they thought, we're safe here. We're east of the Yarden. You know, we'll be okay. Not to mention, as we'll see in a little bit, it was nighttime. It's now the next night. So they don't suspect anything. Gideon does a sneak attack on the camp. Vayanusu zevach v'tzalmuna. And in Pasuk Yibet, sentence 12, they flee. Vayardovach harayim, he goes racing after them. Vayakodes shnei machei midyan, he captures the two kings. As zevach v'tzalmuna. V'chol ha'machaneh hechrid, and he frightened everybody within the camp. Lest you say, well, there are just 300 of him. Right? They should make a movie about this. You know, they should call it 300. It's taken, huh? Lest you say, well, why are they fleeing? Number one, it's nighttime. They don't know how many people he has. But number two, look at what I brought you here on the sheet from, number eight, Ralbag. He says, "Shayuchoshvim sheyiachel Gideon Rav me'asher itam." They thought that Gideon's forces would outnumber theirs, kilayla haya, because it was nighttime. V'itachen shakaru gamkein cherav l'Hashem ulu Gideon hachridam. It could be they used the same tactic all over again, right? Where they surrounded them at night, and then they rallied cherav l'Hashem ulu Gideon, and they blew the shofar and the torches to make it look like there is this this large group, and we know that they were terrified of Gideon. So he manages to conquer them. Well, he's not done with Zebach and Salmuna. We're going to have to come back to them. However, now he's got to go back to Sukkot and Penuel.
You wonder how he knew where they were and to follow them, and there's so many people, and you have 15,000 people. It's chaos. How does he actually locate Zebach and Salmuna?
You mean within the camp of 15,000 people at least?
And know to chase them and capture them.
If I had to guess, and this is pure guess, I don't know anything about how they waged wars in those days, but I wonder if the kings were not the ones who were most heavily guarded, and therefore you sort of know where to go.
Right. Put them in the chaos to actually be able to follow them.
Wouldn't the kings have had sort of their own tent or something fancier, separate from the other people?
I mean, hard to really know.
When you see battles of medieval times, they were always, they had more luxurious tents.
You have to keep in mind two things. Number one is that medieval times are thousands of years later.
For sure.
And the other is that, perhaps more important, these are nomads. They're not, the empires of Europe.
Even so, if they were the kings,
Among the Jews, they did it. Meaning Shaul is in the middle of his camp. David is with his, sometimes he's with his camp. Yoshua we saw, was with the warriors. I don't know, but I do think he'd be better protected. I think you would see a denser population around him.
Yeah.
Than you would around the others. Or it's possible they just, capture enough people and interrogate them and say, where is Zebach and Salmuna? And, that's the way it goes. I don't know. So let's see what happens. Pasuk Yud Gimel, sentence 13. Holding Zebach and Salmuna hostage while this goes on. Vayashav Gideon ben Yoash min ha-milchama milamale hecharas, I should say. So Gideon ben Yoash goes back from the war. I don't know why sometimes he's Gideon and sometimes he's Gideon ben Yoash. But he comes back from the war, Mila Ma'alei Hechares. That's a very interesting phrase. How do you see that translated in your translations? So this last bit of sentence 13.
The sun was still high.
While the sun was high. Okay, that's one translation. You're both working with the same edition. The Judaica Press says, while the sun was high. The ascent of Harris. In other words, Harris is a place. Okay, that's the San Sino. Yes, we did. Timnat Heres.
That's right.
Yes, you did. Good.
Before the sun set, it says here.
Another one that says before the sun set, which is along the lines of the Judaica Press translation. What else do you have?
The sun was high.
The sun was high. Okay.
The place has not been identified.
Okay. Anything else? Okay. So the
Heres and porcelain or clay.
Charis is clay.
Clay.
Yeah. But it doesn't really help us in this one. So there are three different approaches I'll present. The fundamental problem that we have with this is that we don't know of such a place. So what is this? So three explanations. First of all, the word cheres is indeed, as Diane remembered, it's also a reference to the sun. It's used that way in Eov. In Yehoshua, he's buried in a place called either Timnat Serach or Timnat Cheres. It's named in two different ways. And we took that as a reference to the sun. And even in the Medrash, the idea that on his headstone they had an image of the sun to say, because he's the one who stopped the sun. The idea of Cheres as the sun is brought in by everybody on this one. Dat Mikra says this is a place, and it's from the east. Mila ma'ale hechares, from the place where the sun comes up. Ma'ale, right? Okay. Exactly. The place where the sun comes up. So it means he came back from the east. He had been fighting in the east, and now he works his way back west towards the Yarden. And that's a simple explanation. Radak and Mitzudat David offer a second explanation, which mirrors what you had in the Judaic Press one, which is that it's before the sun sets, right? While the sun is still up.
He was fighting at night.
That's, according to these, he's not. According to them, he's fighting by day. However, Radak, in a second approach, as well as Malbim, as well as Abarbanel, say no. He returns before sunrise. Mi actually has two meanings. One could be that it's from, as in before something happens, but rather, the way Abarbanel and Malbim noted is because of Male Hechares. Because the sun is coming up, he has to stop fighting. Why? Because they turn around and realize, he's got the under guys, what are we doing? Exactly. So they pursue the enemy at night, and then they have to come back. Take a look on your sheet, please, at source number 9. Malbim says it. He says, he attacked their camp at night, just like he frightened them the first time, at night. When the sun came up, at that point he retreated. Meaning to say, because the sun had come up, because he had a small group. So therefore he has to go. He could only fight the battle at night. That's the way that he understands milamale hechares. Okay. Which explains also why you needed to say it. Because did I really need to say he's coming back from the east? I mean, obviously he's coming back from the east. We know where he was pursuing them, and we know which way it is to go home. It's not novel. So this is a good explanation. But watch what happens now. Pasuk Yudalad. Oh, we're at 2:25 already. All right, we're going to start this, and then we'll have to come back to it next time. Vayilkod na'ar me'anshe sukos vayish aleyu. He captures a youth from Sukkot, and he asks him, "Vayichtov elav esarei sukos vezikeneha shivim v'shiv aish." And the kid records for him a list of all of the leaders of Sukkot, all of her elders, 77 men. The fact that the kid is able to write this down, Dat Mikra says, this is evidence of the widespread nature of literacy for the Jews, in that time.
Yeah.
Interesting idea. Right.
Mm-hmm. Or it could
be such a bureaucracy. I bet they had like 80 people in the city.
But it could have done Gidon doing the writing, or one of Gidon.
No, Vayichtov Elav. He wrote to him. Gidon is the one. Is the to him? Gidon's the recipient. No, it's the kid who's writing. Vayavo el anshei Sukkot. So Gidon comes to the people of Sukkot. Vayomer, and he said, "Hine zevach v'tzalmuna." You're wondering about these two guys. I've got them for you. Asherech Raftem O.C., about whom you shamed me or responded harshly to me. Lemor is saying, "Hakav zevach v'tzalmuna tabiyadecha." Do you have the hand of zevach and tzalmuna in your hand? Kini tein lanashecha hayyeifim lachem, such that we'll give your tired men bread. Right? You wouldn't give to those tired men of mine. Vayikach esiknei ha'ir. So he takes the elders of the city. Ves kotzei hamidbar, and the wild thorns, ves habarkanim, and the nettles, vayoda bahem es anshei sukot. I'm going to skip the question of what vayoda bahem means. I'm going to assume it means punish, but we have to come back to that word. He punishes the people of Sukkot. Ves migdal Penuel natatz, and then he knocks down the tower, the fortress of Penuel, vayarog es anshei ha'ir, and he kills the residents of the city. So we are going to have an awful lot to ask about here. Right? What? Why did he change what he did to the people of Penuel? Who was it who he hurt in Sukkot?
He said the leaders.
Are you sure?
Certainly seven people.
That's not what he says. Look at Pasuk Ted Zion. He took the elders of the city, he took the thorns and the barkanim, and what did he do?
He broke the men.
The men. The men of Sukkot. Why did he take the elders? Why did he need a list of 77 elders if all he's doing is punishing the men? Or the people, or whatever they are, whatever Anashim means. So we have to come back to this next time, God willing, and get a better understanding of what happened here. Okay.